Okay, so let's come back to the room. Thank you very much to those who have been following the press conference of Mr. Lazzarini. Now let's switch to the regular press briefing. Today is Tuesday, 31st of March here at the UN in Geneva. And I'd like to start immediately with UNHCR. Babar, good morning. You brought us Aser Al-Madayen, who is the UNHCR acting representative in Syria and was connecting from Damascus. I would like to welcome her. I can see you now. And so we will hear from you on the issue of Syrian refugee returns from Lebanon. We'll go straight to, yes, to Aser. Okay, so you have the floor, madam.
Good morning, everyone, from Damascus. I hope you hear me well.
We do. Thank you.
Excellent. So nearly a month after hostilities intensified in the region and in Lebanon, Syria has been has seen a sharp rise in people crossing the border from Lebanon. Between 2nd and 27th of March, more than 200,000 people entered Syria, though through the three official crossing points. These are the figures that have been provided by the authorities, but also confirmed by our colleagues on the ground. The vast majority, nearly 180,000, are Syrians, including Syrian refugees who had fled Syria seeking safety in the past in Lebanon and now forced to flee again, unfortunately. More than 28,000 Lebanese also have crossed into Syria. Most are people fleeing the intense Israeli bombardments. They arrive exhausted, traumatized, and with very, very few belongings. Arrival reflect a mix of profiles, including Syrians who had long considered returning home, as well as families fleeing intensified airstrikes and widespread insecurity in Lebanon. Movements have been heaviest through the Masna' Jdeidet Yabus and Al-Qa' Jusiye crossings, now operating around the clock. However, the Arida crossing reopened only on 27 March, but remains very limited to the pedestrian traffic due to the damaged bridge. Early March saw the largest peak in arrivals, particularly of families coming from Beirut's suburbs and from southern Lebanon as well. Around half of the Syrians we interviewed at the border say they intend to remain permanently in the country, despite limited services and economic challenges. Others, they say that they are planning only a temporary stay in Syria and they wish to return to Lebanon once the situation stabilizes. Most are returning to extended family or rented accommodation, while smaller numbers of Lebanese nationals and Syrian Palestinians have also crossed as part of the mixed profiles or mixed families. Immediate needs of people arriving in Syria from Lebanon include food, shelter, healthcare, livelihoods, and support with civil documentation. Many have arrived without any type of documentation. In close collaboration with the Syrian authorities, UNHCR rapidly scaled up its presence at the three border crossing to ensure timely protection, services, and assistance. Our teams are on the ground on a regular basis, working with partners, NGOs, UN agencies, and outreach volunteers, and leveraging our network of active community centers to engage with arriving families and responding to their urgent needs in areas receiving high numbers of returnees, including in Aleppo, Ar-Raqqa, rural Damascus, Idlib, Deir ez-Zor, and Dar'a and Hamas. UNHCR has already provided legal assistance to hundreds of families needing civil documentation, such as birth or marriage registration, distributed water to more than 30,000 people in transit, delivered essential relief items, including blankets, plastic sheeting, dignity kits, and supplies for children, and organized transport for more than 3,500 people to reach their final destination. We are also working with partners to deliver infrastructure upgrade, such as installing solar street lights to improve safety at the crossing points. In addition, UNHCR is also leading on the coordination among the UN agencies, and working very closely also with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Ministry of Social Affairs to provide some shelter options for families who have no options. Beyond the border areas, our community centers remain the backbone of the response. They help in assessing the needs, register families for services, and offer psychosocial first aid, mental health support, and referrals to legal, medical, education, and child protection services. Our outreach volunteers are helping to ensure assistance reach those most in need. So far, more than 20,000 returnees have received support in governorates across the country. Many families returning describe mix of hardship and uncertainty, and it's very understandable. As one Syrian father who fled Lebanon after heavy shelling told me a few days ago, they came back to Syria, their home country, after having been through a much suffering. They know just now, they just hope the situation here will be better. We must remain by their side to help sustain their return and reintegration, as we have been doing to support the over 3 million Syrians refugees and internally displaced who have voluntarily returned home since December 2024. UNHCR will continue strengthening assistance and protection in needs as needs increase, working closely with authorities and partners to support people now returning home amid difficult conditions. But our UNHCR Syria operation is only less than 30% funded against the nearly 324 million requirements in 2026. And we call for urgent support. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for these remarks, Azir. And before giving the floor to the journalists for questions, I just would like to remind you on Lebanon that the Secretary General condemned the killing of peacekeeper from Indonesia and the wounding of another, and of course shared our deepest condolences with their families and friends, and wish recovery, swift recovery to the wounded one. But also I would like to call your attention on the statement that the UN Special Coordinator for Lebanon, Janine Hennis-Plasschaert, has issued yesterday night, where she brings the number of casualties to 3 UN peacekeepers who have lost their lives while serving in southern Lebanon in the past 24 hours. 9 Lebanese paramedics were killed in just one day, and the death toll from the escalation in hostilities between Hezbollah and Israel since 2nd of March now stands at 1,247. I think the statement by Mrs. Annie's pleasure is particularly strong, so I'd like to send you to that particular statement for more information. She concludes her statement by saying, tactical military gains may produce short-term wins on and off the battlefield, but they risk irrevocable long-term damage to the stability and prosperity both for Lebanese and Israeli deserve. It is time to think in the long term. It is time to move forward the process which builds rather than destroys. And I'll open the floor to questions now in the room first. AFP, Lina Narsson.
Yes. Hi, thank you for the briefing. I was wondering what kind of contingency planning you have in place and how many people you're expecting to see. There's already very large numbers crossing the border. How do you see that developing going forward, and what are your plans? Thanks.
Go ahead, Azin.
Yeah. No, thank you for the question. We have, of course, a contingency plan as the UN as a whole, of course. And we have, of course, our own contingency plan as UNHCR. Now, the anticipated number, it really depends very much whether there will be more land operations, but we are prepared for the 350,000. At the same time, the Syrian government has shared with us that they are now putting a contingency plan in case that they will see more Lebanese coming to Syria.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you very much. Do you have a sort of a time frame for that contingency plan? So if you're saying you're prepared for 300,000 to 350,000, in what time frame? And from the Syrian government, are the 300,000 to 350,000, are those mainly Syrians that you're thinking of, or how do you split that? Thanks.
When we did the initial planning, it was we expected, of course, the largest to be Syrians, considering the time of conflict. We anticipated the largest number will be Syrians, but also Lebanese. Depending on how the situation evolves, we may see more Lebanese. So we are prepared for mixed of Lebanese and Syria, but for the Lebanese, certainly we need more engagement. We need the government, and we were very relieved when the government is really taking the lead on the contingency planning for receiving Lebanese. On the time frame, there is. We are just prepared for the crossing, but definitely we need now, in light of the situation, to review and see what are the needs and the gaps and the expected figures depending on the situation.
Thank you very much. Other questions in the room? Don't see any hand up. Let me see if there is any on the platform. I don't see any. Babar, before we conclude, do you want to add anything? It's okay. Okay, so thank you very much. I'd like to thank you, Ms. Azia Al-Madayen, UNHCR Acting Representative in Syria, and just remind you that, as you may have seen, the Security Council is going to meet on the situation in the Middle East and Lebanon this afternoon at 4 p.m. Geneva time, that is following the incidents involving the UNIFIL peacekeepers. I believe, is that for Babar or for Azir? For me? Okay, just go ahead.
Just on the UNIFIL peacekeepers, please. Do you know the three nationalities in the past 24 hours? And was this the deadliest incident ever or since when? Thank you.
On the deadliest incident, maybe Asir knows more. I don't have the nationalities, Emma, but we'll try. I know that it was particularly difficult to access the area where the incidents occurred. So and until yesterday night and this morning, I didn't have that information. But I'll try to fetch it for you. I don't know, Azir, if you want to say anything on those incidents in particular. No, we can't hear you.
Yeah, no. I actually don't have any additional information, but we can try to see what information we can get. But no, at this moment, no.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll try to get more as soon as possible. Any other question on Lebanon? I don't see any hand up. So thanks again, Azir and Babar. And let's go to the second part of our briefing. Thank you, Azir, for coming in from Damascus. And now I'd like to turn to Corinne Fleischer, the director of the supply chain of the World Food Programme. Welcome, madam. You are joining in from Rome, and you will be briefing us on the impact of supply chain disruptions on the World Food Programme delivery of life-saving food assistance to its frontline operation, given to the current geopolitical situation. So I'll give you the floor, please.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. Yeah, for us, it's the most significant disruption of supply chains that we have seen since COVID and the beginning of the war in Ukraine. The World Food Programme has currently 70,000 metric tons of food that is impacted by the war in the Middle East. About half of them are on chartered bulk vessel, and the other half are in containers, which are either en route or stuck in a port and don't move. The impact is, of course, because of the Strait of Hormuz. The World Food Programme has no vessels in the Strait of Hormuz. We don't ship things from, into the Middle East, and also not into the Gulf of into the Gulf, but also not out, of course. But we are impacted by the ripple effect of what's happening there, with vessels being stuck in the Strait of Hormuz. This, of course, has a whole upstream effect on vessels being, stuck in ports, not berthing to ports, not leaving ports, containers not being offloaded. That leads to a capacity constraint of containers. They are either not there or at the wrong place when they should be loaded. So it's a whole disruption of a global supply chain that what we've seen after COVID has taken like 4 to 5 months to get back into place once the situation stabilized. So we're looking at the longer term situation where we will be impacted by higher costs and lead times. Where we are directly impacted, and this is where it goes beyond the Middle East into the Horn of Africa, is the Bab el Mandeb, with carriers not using the Suez Canal, the Red Sea, and with that having to make a whole route through the Horn of Africa, Cape of Good Hope, into Eastern Africa. That adds about 25 to 30 days of shipping, and between 15 to 25% of rates, because of course longer operations, more fuel required, and of course more expensive fuel. So what WFP is doing right now is, first and foremost, we are asking carriers. The World Food Programme is the only UN organization with its own shipping department, directly engaging with shipping lines and vessel owners. So we are asking for priority cargo for humanitarian operations, number one, which we do in these type of situations, and oftentimes it works. Secondly, we're trying to minimize the cost increases that we see. So we have negotiated a waiver of the surcharges that are being put in place by shipping lines on certain ports at risk in the Middle East, of between $2,000 to $4,000 per container. That's about $200 per metric ton additional. So this has been waived, which gives us cost avoidance of about already $1.5 million by now. So really great how we are getting the response from the shipping lines on that. And then lastly, we are also rerouting cargo. And this is quite significant. And I can give you an example for example, Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 17 million people are food insecure. We need to get there. We are sourcing quite a bit in Pakistan. That got impacted by the war between Pakistan and Afghanistan. So we rerouted it to come in through Iran. While we were on the rerouting way to get into Bandar Abbas port of Iran, the war broke out. We had to put it in Jebel Ali in Dubai. And now we will truck it from Dubai through Saudi Arabia, through Jordan, Syria, Turkey, Azerbaijan, and then into Turkmenistan, and then into Afghanistan. So that adds about 1,000 euros per ton, and of course another 3 weeks. But it also allows us to test and open a land route should this last for longer. Lastly, what I'd like to say is just, of course, we're very concerned with the long-term impact that this war has on people being able to put food on the table. You know, the people that we are concerned about are not those who go to fuel stations to fill up their cars. They're those who spend already between 50 and 70% of their income on food. And if that you know, cost of living increases, as we see in several countries now, they won't be able to put food on the table any longer. And that our projections are that by June, 45 million more people will be acutely hungry. You've heard us say that before. Right now it's 318 million, we'll go to 362 million. And of course, not the financing for humanitarian operations at this point, even less than before, to support us to help these people. So we're very concerned with more needs, higher costs, and us not being able to then reach people because of the combination of that. Just to give you an example, in Lebanon, we already see the local transport costs go up by 45%. In Afghanistan, with all the rerouting we'll have to do, it's going up three times. And so this translates into higher food prices everywhere. So big concern there. I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks. That was really the combination of the perfect storm. I'll start the question with Reuters. By the way, Emma, just on your previous question, just put you in the chat. I wanted to confirm that the three peacekeepers killed on 29 and 30th of March were from Indonesia, serving UNIFIL. And of course, we want to reiterate that peacekeepers are not a target, and attacks on peacekeepers may constitute war crimes. The UN urges all actors to ensure the safety and security of peacekeepers at all times. And I'll come back to you on the fact that if it was the deadliest attack. And now, please, can you ask your question to Corinne? Emma is from Reuters. Corinne.
Okay. If there's any way of sending that to me. Hello. It's red. Okay. If there's any way of sending that to me, because I'm not on the Zoom, that would be great. Thank you, Alessandra. Two questions, please. Thanks for that really interesting briefing. Are you involved at all in the talks to create a mechanism to keep the trade flowing through the Strait of Hormuz? There's that UN initiative announced on Friday. If not, could you just say how much hope you have invested in that working? Secondly, given that this is the second time this has happened in a few years, have you given any thought to shortening your supply chains and sourcing more food closer to destination countries as a result of these sorts of disruptions? Thank you.
Corinne?
You want me to come in now? Yeah, okay. So yes, so what has been announced on Friday is under the Secretary General. I think the details are being worked out. And WFP will stand ready to support if we are requested. But the details are not yet available. On very good question on the shortening of supply chain, as you mentioned that. You know, the World Food Programme already buys whenever possible and competitive in local markets. And so, of course, we have now, we are relooking at our overall sourcing operations to see whether it's more cost effective to do it in local markets. But prices will be increasing in local markets substantially as well. And so we have to be careful not to disrupt those markets. But every procurement action right now is looked at best source and giving a special look again.
Thank you very much. Other questions in the room? Yes, please, Suisse Info, Dorian.
Hi, thank you. I'm wondering, you mentioned in Afghanistan, for example, the food price increases, or just the higher cost of bringing food there. Does this also mean that you're serving less people there? Are you worried about this? And can you maybe also give us a few other examples of countries where this is now having a really bad impact? Thank you.
Yes, we are very concerned of us being able to reach less people, because of course, if the costs rise, that means the cost per person to support a person rises, and so we will support less people. We are very concerned of all our big operations, actually, because they're either in the Middle East, you know, Lebanon. Thankfully, our preparedness action allowed us to immediately ship food into Lebanon at the onset of the war from Turkey. We have stocks in Turkey, for regional preparedness stocks in Turkey. So we've done that. But we're very concerned about, for example, Sudan. Sudan, 19 million people acutely hungry. Somalia, 7 million people acutely hungry. South Sudan, because they are affected by the by carriers not using the Suez Canal, and the longer lead time and the higher costs. Now, the thing is that, you know, the financing of humanitarian operations has, you know, since several years not being where it should be. So we have eroded any buffer stocks. We're living from hand to mouth in these operations. You have famine in pockets in areas in Sudan. So there is no time. People don't have the time, and our operations and pipelines don't allow for a 3 weeks longer rerouting through the Horn of Africa. So there will be pipeline disruptions, and in the end, people not receiving their food. If you look at Somalia, you know, we're seeing already food price increases from about 20% since the war, and for certain staple commodities up to 70%. This has a massive impact on people's lives. And, you know, also the fertilizer, not being available as planting season starts. We are of course concerned of the 500 million smallholder farmers in this world who barely produce enough to make ends meet with their families, let alone of course selling into the market. But if now they produce less or don't even produce, as you see at times when costs of production go up and they don't have the cash flow to do that, then they won't produce, and these people will fall into needing humanitarian assistance.
Thank you very much. I see you nodding. It's okay. Thank you very much for this. Let me go to the platform. Antonio Broto, a Spanish news agency.
Good morning. So first I would like to ask if the bottlenecks are affecting WFP operations only in the Middle East and the East of Africa, or also the regions in the world are affected. If so, which ones? Can you mention some examples? And second, I think you said your costs are increasing by $1,000 per ton. Do you have a broader figure how this translates into the costs of WFP operations in 1 month or 1 day? Thank you.
Thank you. Let me just come in on the second question you had. So I'm not saying that this is a overall cost of 1,000 metric ton. I gave that example, specific example, into Afghanistan. We have another example of, you know, rice for Tajikistan that went through the same kind of odyssey, and we had to route it through the Horn of Africa. That has an increase of 500 euros per ton. So it depends, of course, on every situation and every destination, and from where to where we have to bring the cargo. But of course, so we don't have, you know, a global increase yet, and the impact of that yet, because we're still assessing. But you know, if freight charges go up by between 10% and 20%, this will have a massive impact on our shipping operations. And then, of course, with the fuel price increases, we already have transporters either not answering our tenders because they're worried to fix a price, or immediately now asking and come back and asking for increase. You know, we're using Egypt as a corridor into Gaza. The fuel price increase in Egypt has an impact on these operations, and transporters being very concerned, and of course trying to manage their risks. And you know, transporters managing risks means they're giving us higher prices. So our teams around the globe are now looking at how to, you know, mitigate. Of course, if we have to, we will increase the rates, but very short term, and making sure that we can know the markets exactly, so that we are not, you know, getting into too high costs, because our volumes are just too big, you know, to close an eye on a cost increase for sure. Whether other regions are impacting, well, the fuel crisis impacts definitely Asia. Myanmar is very much impacted. And so that, of course, will further down the line, you know, what you have as a supply chain crisis today will become the hunger crisis of tomorrow, with local market rates increasing. But we are not, and this is why we don't have, you know, a direct impact and vessels in the Strait of Hormuz. We are, of course, not shipping food into the Gulf because they don't need that. And we're also not taking food out of the Gulf in large quantities. We have our humanitarian response depot, which we have on behalf of the humanitarian community in each continent. So our large one is in Dubai, in the humanitarian city of Dubai. We are quite grateful to the government of the UAE. We're getting priority for air shipments, because you know, lots of these things in the humanitarian response depot is not food, so lots gets shipped by air, and we're also using overland to get out of into a port that is out of the Strait of Hormuz. So we're managing, we're operating, but of course we need to manage the costs and the lead times.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Is there any other question for WFP online or in the room? I don't see any other hand up. Corinne, thank you so much for this update. It's very important that we keep this more general discussion on the effect of the more general effect of the situation. Just wanted to tell Dorian, who had asked about the situation, political work that we are doing about the Strait of Hormuz, that the Secretary General had a series of calls with Ambassador last week to brief them, and at the moment, Jorge Moreira da Silva, who, as you know, has been nominated as coordinator of the task force that is concentrating on the development of a mechanism to have safe, orderly, and predictable maritime transit for humanitarian purposes through the Strait of Hormuz. This is the official definition. He is in New York this week, and he is having an in-depth conversation with a number of member states, so we will be able to give you a little bit more, I hope, soon. And as you may remember, Juliette Tuma, that we all know well, is the director of communication for UNOPS. And so if you wish to reach out to her, they've also put out a statement quite recently about this. So if there are no other questions to Corinne or on this subject, thank you very much again, Corinne, for joining us here in Geneva. Please come back, keep us informed. And now let's go to the last, thank you, to the last part of the briefing with Kennedy. Kennedy, you have a briefing on the situation in Sudan and your appeal. Please.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. Just to maintain the conversation within the Middle East is that in Sudan, more than 9 million people remain internally displaced. while an estimated 3.8 million people have begun returning to their areas of origin. These overlapping movements of displacement and returns are shaping one of the most complex humanitarian crises in the world today. For families still displaced, daily life means limited access to shelter, food, clean water, and health services. For those returning, the situation can be equally difficult. Many communities they return to have damaged infrastructure, limited livelihoods, and disrupted services. In some areas, unexploited ordinances continue to pose serious risk. As a result, both displaced and returning population face urgent humanitarian needs. At the peak of the conflict, more than 12 million people were internally displaced within the country. While displacement continues in areas such as Darfur, Kordofan, and the Blue Nile states, returns are taking place in locations including Gedaref, Khartoum, and the River Nile states. Some families return because security conditions appear to have improved. Others are driven by economic pressures, family separations, or the lack of services in displacement sites. These movements are closely linked to a wider regional impact. Neighboring countries are receiving large numbers of arrivals. Chad, South Sudan have seen the largest influx. South Sudan has received more than 1.3 million people, while Chad has received 1.2 million people. A large share of those crossing borders are returning nationals, with more than 900,000 coming with more than 900,000 people returning to South Sudan, and equally nearly 389,000 to Chad. Many arrived with few resources or family networks at all, placing additional pressures in communities that already face limited services. People moving along these routes face serious protection risks as well, including trafficking, exploitation, gender-based violence, and family separation. Immediate assistance at border areas remain critical, including shelter, essential household items, cash support, safe water, reception services, and onward transportation. In response to the growing needs, today the International Organization for Migration is appealing for $227 million to support the most vulnerable people affected by displacement and the conflict in Sudan and its neighboring countries in 2026. The appeal focuses on strengthening the systems that sustain the humanitarian operations. This includes improving data and mobility tracking, expanding humanitarian hubs and supply routes, and strengthening cross-border operations. One priority is expanding the existence of the humanitarian hub in Fashana in eastern Chad, which helps deliver aid into the hard-rich areas of Darfur and Kordofan. Alongside emergency assistance, the appeal also seeks to support restore basic services to areas of return, rebuilding livelihoods and helping communities create conditions for people to rebuild their lives safely. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kennedy, for this briefing and for keeping the Sudan under the spotlight. It's very important. So let me see if there's any question for you in the room or online. I don't see any. So thank you very much again. And that concludes our briefing. Let me just read to you an announcement. I just wanted to remind you that the second part of the annual session of the Conference on Disarmament will officially begin on 11th of May, so they have now closed. But the president of the Conference on Disarmament will not convene meetings of the conference throughout the duration of the review conference of the NPT, namely through the week of 19th of May. Some of you had asked for it. And then, of course, for the Human Rights Council, see what Pascal has sent out. Otherwise, I don't have other information. Oh, I see Gabriella. Okay. So first of all, Kennedy, there is a question from Peter. In fact, not a question, but a request that you share your notes on Sudan. And I see Gabriella has raised her hand. Gabriella.
Hi, hello, good morning, Alessandra.
Good morning.
I was late at the briefing, but I just want to ask something about Israel and Palestine, if it's possible.
I mean, it depends to whom you want to ask it.
Yeah, to you.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if the Secretary General or you issue any comment on this, but yesterday, Israel National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, I don't know how to pronounce it, celebrated with a glass of champagne after the Israel Knesset passed a law to execute Palestinian detainees. So raise a glass of champagne to celebrate, to execute Palestinian detainees. I don't know if Secretary General or a human rights office or someone has something to say on this, because I don't know how to qualify something like this.
Okay, so we might have comments today on this particular issue, but in the meantime, I'd like to send you back to what Commissioner General Lazzarini just said at the press conference he gave here at 9:30, where he, of course, said that what we are accustomed to see is democratic countries renouncing the death penalty and not reinstating death penalty. And above all, in this particular case, he pointed out the fact that this law would apply only to Palestinian people, which of course is quite unprecedented. But you may just refer to the transcript of what he said. We've made it available, so please don't hesitate. And maybe we will have more today on this. But in general terms, I think we can all reiterate that the United Nations has been very clear on its position on death penalty, which should not be applied anywhere for anyone. And also maybe if you want to ask a comment from the colleagues at OHCHR. But really, I invite you to read the comments of Philip Lazzarini, which are really strong and quite clear. Thank you very much to you all. I don't see any other hand up. So I won't see you on Friday, because Friday is a holiday at the UN. And good that I remember to remind you that we will not have the briefing, because the Palais will be closed. And that will be the case also on Monday. So we'll have a long weekend, and we will continue informing you through email on the various news that we issue. So thank you very much. Wish you a very good long weekend, and we'll see you next week on Tuesday. Thank you.